What's up, guys? It's a great day. This is Fuquan Bilal, and we are back with another great episode of the PFREI podcast series. We interview experts in the real estate business in order to provide you with some of the best investment strategies and techniques used by leading fund managers, financiers, house flippers, and more. We appreciate every single one of you for taking the time to press play on the podcast and hope you enjoy this new episode. All right, guys, it's another great episode of PFREI. I'm your host, Fuquan Bilal. We're back again with another great show. Today, we have an attorney in the house. So this is probably the third attorney I think we had on the show, maybe the second, I think, Bill. I've been really trying to bring you guys to the platform to kind of, you know, help real estate investors, just everyday people in general, with some of the services you do. Other than real estate stuff, things that I think that are important. So we'll get into the show. We'll talk about that. But I have William Dolan, Dolan Law LLC. I'll let you talk about your background and some of the things that you specialize in, and then we'll jump right into it. So we talked about real estate earlier. You told me you used to have some real estate stuff, so you understand the concept of that. But just give everybody a background, give the listeners, you know, a little flavor of the service you provide and who you are as a person.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, Fuquan, thanks for having me. It's good to see you. It's been quite a while. When I first started practicing law, I started at a big corporate firm working with people who were writing the LLC acts and the corporate acts and kind of cutting my teeth on those kind of things. But a few years after that, I decided to start my own firm where I could work more hands-on with real estate investors and smaller direct business owners, because law was a second career for me. So before I was a practicing lawyer, I owned several businesses. I owned a couple of mortgage companies, a title company, and I was a real estate investor myself. Not full-time. I probably did about 50 deals, mostly flips, had quite a few rentals for a while, 10, 12, you know, that's quite a few to me to manage. And I did a couple of development projects too, bought some lots at the beach, built some houses on them and resold them.
Okay, so you have some real experience.
Yeah, I mean, and I enjoyed it. And, you know, really everything I did sort of revolved around real estate. I mean, I had a couple of other little entrepreneurial things I helped people out with, but you know, the mortgage business revolves around real estate, title work revolves around real estate, of course, real estate investing. So, you know, when I was working at that big firm, we did some big real estate deals. You know, we were doing loans that were secured by big hotel chains, the Plaza and in New York and all of that. But man, it was, you know, these deals were just monsters. You know, it didn't feel like you were really doing a real estate deal. You were, you know, one little piece of it was like 300 pages long, you know. Real estate felt pretty, you know, far removed from that. So when I started my practice, I wanted to deal more with real estate investors and lenders and, you know, people that were right there on the front lines, like I used to be, you know, doing deals. But, you know, I was also able to bring some of the bigger corporate experience too. So, you know, a lot of my clients have either grown or, you know, they're sort of like mid-sized real estate investors where it gets a little more complicated. You know, maybe they're raising money or, you know, they've got a lot of different entities. Maybe they want to do some estate planning. Privacy is a concern, you know, that, you know, allows me to bring what I learned, you know, from the big corporate firm into the mix too.
Yeah, I think that's important. You know, you do a variety of things, and that's kind of what I like about your shop, because you have an understanding of real estate. So you have these type of investors come to you to be set up, you know, for certain things. You know, it's important, and you're very knowledgeable too of certain things, you know, when it comes to mortgages and structuring deals and stuff like that. So that real estate experience do kick in mixed with the legal aspect of it. I can see you have the double advantage.
Yeah. And even now, so my practice is, you know, I would say probably about 45% like straight on real estate deals, about 45% sort of like corporate work. And a lot of that's, you know, forming LLCs and partnerships to do real estate deals, but it's really focused more on kind of the corporate side. And then about 10% of my practice is drafting loan documents and doing lender rep on real estate deals mainly. You know, it's doing title commitments, drafting notes and guarantees and mortgages and, you know, assignment of rents and, you know, those kind of documents. So even today, out of all that, probably easily 70 to 80% of what I do touches real estate.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the trust aspect of it, which you do on that side of the business. You know, in a certain, I don't want to call them products, but services actually that you offer on that side of the thing, helping people get set up with the family trust and basically, you know, what comes along with that as well.
Yeah. So one of the questions we get all the time when someone has LLCs or corporations is, you know, what happens if I die, you know, or I become disabled or whatever the case is? You know, we'll focus on death here for the moment. You know, what happens if I become deceased? Where does all of these, you know, where do all these LLCs go? Who gets them? How do they get there? Does it go through probate? You know, and all these kinds of questions. And there's nothing better for estate planning than a trust. I mean, that's really what trusts were originally designed for. They were actually, you know, think back to the Magna Carta days, you had landowners that would go out and fight the Crusades, and that's kind of the time period when trust started. And they would leave someone in charge of their estate. And that's where the first trust was created. You know, Lord so-and-so went off to fight in the Crusades and, you know, left somebody back at home in charge of everything and trusted that person with the responsibility to care for his affairs. And that's really, you know, that's really what it is. So you can start with like a living trust, revocable trust while you're alive. You can create a trust where you're the trustee, you control everything, you're the primary beneficiary. But if you become deceased without anything going through probate and that whole messy, complicated process, you can automatically have beneficiaries set up, you know, whether it's a spouse, your kids, whoever, you have your chain of trustees, those successors are built into the trust agreement as well. And none of this needs, it doesn't need to go through a court. It doesn't need to go through the probate. It's easier, it's simpler, it's quicker. And that you can't do that with an LLC. An LLC doesn't have succession concepts built into it. That's where the trust, you kind of marry the trust and the LLC together, or you can use it with a corporation or any other kind of asset to give you that ability to control your assets. And
yeah, I mean, it's definitely the right thing to do, but when you get down to behind the scenes now, putting it together, it really makes you think of who you're going to bestow that trust in. And I think that just drags the process out forever, because you come to realization like, holy crap, like you're thinking about afterlife now and how that's going to play out and who can you trust to do that. And most of the time you'll find it's not even your own family. Who, you know, I'm pretty sure on the other side, you probably see a lot of that. You know, people find someone who they can depend on. So, yeah, that's great. I think everybody should definitely have that set up if you're not even in a real estate business or an investor. I think this is something basic that everybody should have. But I don't think a lot of people really focus on this. I mean, is people banging down your door to get these set up and, you know, working on this type of stuff or more transactions?
Yeah, they don't. And you know, it's funny to hear you say, you know, once you have to start to think about these issues, it does slow people down. And I joke around with clients all the time, well, if you want to start a business and form an LLC, that tends to happen very quickly. When someone wants to do a trust or a will or a durable power of attorney or an advanced healthcare directive, it takes a really long time. And I have had so many people, no, but I'm going to be the exception. You're going to send me those documents, those questions. I'm going to fill those things out. I'll have it to you by the end of the weekend. Here we are like a month or 2 months later. I'm like, hey, you're still working on that form. And they're
it's
like,
tough. Oh,
man, like,
it makes them think. It does.
It's tough. It's tough. My wife and I went through the same thing when we were doing it for ourselves. You know, it's tough for all of us. You know, if you have kids, if something happens to you and the kids are still minors, who do you want to be the guardian for your kids? That's a deep question. And if that person's unwilling or unavailable or whatever the case is at the time, what, who do you want to be the next person in line? You know,
yeah.
tough question.
Yeah. I know you do some stuff with the banks also, you know, with the lender docs and stuff like that. You help private lenders. You want to talk about that a little bit, how you make sure they had the right documents and everything in place. You know, even some, you represent some banks doing commercial loans too, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I do a little bit of work for some commercial lend, like kind of traditional licensed commercial lenders, but most of what I do is for private lenders. And it's interesting because a lot of them, it takes a little while to learn where does the underwriting end and the legal process start. You know, like as a lender, they're going to underwrite their own deals. They need to make sure that they think the value's in the real estate. They need to make sure the numbers work. But on the legal side, a lot of times it's, hey, you know, we'd like to find a way to make this deal work, but we need to make sure we're secured. How do we do that? That's usually the main question, aside from kind of the easy one, like what's the interest rate? Of course, you got to have a note that says what the interest rate is and the points and the payments and that kind of stuff. But it's really the collaterals where the action is. And people come all the time and say, well, how do we know we're going to get a first mortgage? How do we know maybe we're going to be in second position? You know, sometimes you can't do a mortgage because there's the existing first lender won't allow it. And then we have to try and get more creative and say, well, okay, can they pledge their LLC interest in the LLC that owns the real estate? Can we get some collateral there at that level? And so on the front end, there's always a discussion and an analysis around, you know, what collateral is available, you know, and, you know, what can we target? And then after that, we have to make sure that it's, you know, what the borrower thinks it is, right? If it's a first lien position or a second lien position, we'll generally require that a title company get involved and do a title search. If it's a big enough loan, we'll generally require title insurance to assist with that too. But, you know, but I review the title commitments and make sure, you know, look at the exceptions and the exclusions and those things to make sure that they're right. Draft the promissory note, any personal guarantees, mortgage, assignment of rents, you know, those types of things. But there are other issues that creep up too, like usury. You know, and that's something that the usury laws vary state by state. For anyone doesn't know, usury is that, you know, all states have laws that say if you charge an interest rate in excess of, you know, X, then that's a violation of the law. And in most states, there's pretty stiff penalties. Some states, it's criminal. Some states, it's just civil, and there's just a really hefty penalty for charging above usury. So knowing how to navigate the usury laws is really important too. And lenders don't really know that. They just, you know, and this is what they should focus on. They should focus on make the business deal work. And then you come to someone like me and we're supposed to make sure you're going to get the collateral, make sure you're not going to violate the law. And sometimes it causes us to have to massage the deal a little bit.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
They come back and say, well, you know, this just about works, but we kind of just need to tweak this piece here or that piece there, so that it actually, you know, works within the framework of the law or works within the framework of, you know, how we can secure the collateral or, you know, whatever the issue is. But there's generally more involved in it than people think. I think because these deals happen all the time, there tends to be a feeling of like, oh, well, since it happens so often, it must be easy, you know. Just because something happens a lot doesn't mean it's easy to do. You know, there's a lot of moving pieces to it.
Yeah, but, sure.
But look, there's a huge market for private lending because banks these days are conservative. I mean, it's hard because I represent quite a few business owners too, and they get SBA loans and other commercial loans. And I mean, they'll ask for everything but your firstborn. And
yeah.
6, 9 months. I mean, it just takes so long. It's crazy. And a private lender, I got two requests a couple of days ago, and we're going to fund several million dollars worth of these loans in the next couple of days. I mean, you're talking like a week's period of time. You know, that's not ideal, right? But private lenders in certain situations can move that quickly, depending on the circumstances. And you're going to pay for it, right? You're going to pay a higher rate, probably some higher fees to do that. But if it's a business deal, it's all dollars and cents. You know, it's Dion talking about they're buying some properties out of a bankruptcy sale. Time is important. But if you don't close on time, you're not going to get the deals, you know.
So they're utilizing you to do the lender docs and package it together to secure them and make sure they're good. And then they'll fund the transaction. So you pretty much do that part of it. You do that nationwide, or are you only doing that in the states where you are?
No, I do that. I do that across the country. So we'll make. Obviously, I'm actually licensed in Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, but most of the loan documents I make governed by Delaware law, because Delaware is favorable in certain aspects. So we make the note, the guarantee, and quite a few of the other documents based on Delaware law. If there's a mortgage or deed of trust, that's obviously going to be governed by the state in which the property is located. So sometimes we have to bring in local counsel to draft like a deed of trust or something to do one part of the deal.
Got it.
Of course, a lot of my clients, most of them have Delaware LLCs. So, there's that kind of Delaware tie-in too. But yeah, we do loans, loan docs for people. We just did one in Florida. The one I'm talking about now is in Ohio, within Georgia, California, and Illinois.
Yeah, I had a question on fractionalized mortgages. Is that something you're familiar with?
If you're using it in the context, which I think you are, then yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking of deal structure, right? I always try to figure out how to make this deal work. So I'm gonna run a scenario to you. You throw your legal hat on real quick. You tell me. All right. I have a deal, and I have let's say three people, more than two, keyword, that I want to try to create a scenario and do a fractionalized mortgage. I want to, I guess, give them all equal share of the deal, and they be under an LLC, I'm guessing, and they all fund the LLC, which then funds the investor for the loan and the property. That's my thought of a fractionalized mortgage. What I hear is, okay, it's more than two people, SEC alert, that should be in a fund, or that should be in a syndication or something like that. But I heard something about this fractionalized mortgage piece that can be used in that format. I didn't know, just trying to get clarity on that. So legal hat, what do you have to say?
Sure. Yeah, I love it. So there are securities laws that when someone is investing money in essentially, I'm just going to kind of distill it down to simple jargon, right? So if you're making like a passive investment, then the party who's raising the money is subject to securities laws, which says either the security has to be registered with the SEC, or that you have to use one of the exemptions to registration. And then you got to follow those kind of convoluted rules, which still a lot of times require you to provide a PPM or an OM or something, and discharge all these obligations. Usually we try to structure around that for a transaction like what you're talking about. It's different if someone's going to raise, $10, $20, $30 million, and they're going to be cycling through the money. That's probably more of like a fund. You probably do need to consider that a security. You do need to have a PPM and all that stuff. But for like what you're talking about, if it's like a single deal, let's say, there's a few different ways you could do it. You could have an LLC formed, and they could contribute the money to the LLC, and that LLC could be the lender on that deal. Or they could each have a separate direct note to the borrower, and those notes could all be secured by the same mortgage document, pari passu, or with equal dignity. And we do that all the time. So,
I get excited for stuff like this. I get excited for the out of the box stuff. Go ahead, preach.
Yeah. This happens all the time. When they're a direct lender, it's not a security. They're not a passive investor. They're a lender at that point. So the securities laws are not going to be an issue in that situation. And you can do creative things with it. Under the mortgage, they can all be equal. They can, you could actually have different priorities too. You could have two of them be sort of equal in first position and a third note be subordinate to those. And we can describe all that. It takes a little bit of special language, but it's not that complicated.
So all of this is happening inside of the first mortgage that's being created.
Right.
As a fractionalized mortgage where people have, whatever position they have in that vehicle, which is funding the LLC, which is funding the lender. Interesting. A small transaction, $1 million, $500,000, something like that. Would that be commonly used for?
I have quite a few private lenders that they have what they call funders that want to kind of like fund the deals, and a lot of times that structure is used to do that. And it's good because you can avoid those security issues, right? The securities issues. You don't have to go through those complicated processes. I mean, theoretically, and I do have some lenders that do this too, sometimes, but this is only usually when there's like a conduit lender, you know, when there's sort of like almost like investors in the lender, they'll have that party loan money to the lender, and the lender turns around and lends it back out to the borrower. But that's a little bit different than the situation you described, where there's three people that can all be direct lenders. So the one thing I'll add to that, though, is when you have that situation where you have three note holders secured by the same mortgage, you want to have somebody as the nominee, somebody, you know, because you have three people. How do you decide when it's time to foreclose if that happens, right? Somebody's got to make that decision. You don't want there to be an argument. Well, one person doesn't want to do it, two people do, so there's majority rule. You know, how does that work? So we would typically have a nominee.
Okay. And
usually that's one of the three will sort of play the lead in that. I mean, it doesn't have to work that way. You could have like an inter-creditor agreement, which we do that sometimes too, where there's like kind of a side agreement where they decide how they're going to make those decisions. You know, is it going to be a vote? Is it going to be based on outstanding, who has the most outstanding, you know, principal and interest at that moment in time? What's going to be the mechanism to drive that? Because the lawyer, we're always thinking about that. We don't want there to be a deadlock.
And
everything's frozen because there's a disagreement and the documents don't solve the disagreement, you know?
Yeah, this is good stuff. I really appreciate it, man. I mean, plug your YouTube also. I saw you started doing videos. I catch your videos. I think they're great. Keep them coming. Keep them coming. Man, you're not doing enough. You got to do 10 a week.
Oh, man, I wish.
No, I love it, though. I love it. It's educational. I'm glad you did it. I don't know if it was the pandemic that, you know, forced your hand and had you start doing it, but I'm glad you launched it. And you guys should go check out his YouTube channel. You want to plug your YouTube real quick?
Yeah. It's called Esquire Advice. So Esquire Advice, you can just type that into YouTube. It'll come up. We have quite a few videos. And you talk about what motivated me to do it. I was actually thinking about doing it before the pandemic because I feel like there's so much foundational information that a lot of times I either don't have time to give to clients, or they don't know that they need it, so they don't really want to pay me for it, right? So in either of those situations, I was like, there's got to be another way for me to deliver this information to kind of get the client to where the client needs to be for us to then, you know, move forward and get their deals done. And so I was like, let me come up with these videos where I can give them that foundational information. I give them the baseline so that where I know they're at like a good place to actually get into the meat of the deal. And we're not spinning our wheels explaining really like rudimentary concepts. But, you know, I know that's not always the case to the other people. Sometimes people hear all these legal concepts and jargon and they're like, whoa, wait, what does that mean? But yeah, so those videos, and I use them in my practice all the time. Like people will say, well, you know, why should I use a Delaware LLC? It's like, if I don't have time to sit and explain it, it's like, hey, you know, I happen to have a video on that. Why don't you listen to that? Or, you know, how do I maximize my LLC?
You know what I imagine? You have a screen where somebody asks a question, you just push a button and the video goes out to
I would answer that, but I don't need to because I can click this button. Here you go.
All right. Thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Dolan Law LLC. William Dolan, thank you so much for sharing us information. We got a jewel from you. PFREI, another great episode. I'm your host, Fupan Bilal. Go check out his YouTube channel. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and all other couple of hundred social media channels that we on. Thanks, guys. I appreciate you tuning in.
Thank you guys for listening to this episode of the Passion for Real Estate Investments podcast. Looking forward to providing you guys with more testimonials from successful real estate investors. Be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at @passion4REI. Thanks so much, guys. And until next time, it's a great day.